It is my pleasure to introduce the final keynote speaker of our conference. Professor Donald Worster is the Joyce and Elizabeth Hall Professor of U.S. History and Environmental Studies at the University of Kansas. He is a prolific author in these fields, and indeed is one of the founders, we could say, of the entire field of environmental history. You'll know from my talk on Thursday night that he certainly has been one of the most influential thinkers and inspirations for my own work, and I just could not be more delighted than to welcome him here to wrap up the third meeting of the International Society for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture. He'll be drawing on work that he explored in his most recent book, which is a biography of John Muir, entitled A Passion for Nature. So please join me in welcoming Professor Donald Worster.
Actually, I would like to start by saying amen to John's critique of the growth mania in neoclassical economics, and another amen to Eric's critique of domination, especially epistemological domination, which is my own bet noir. But this is coming out of biography. Not mine life, but the life of a 19th century American that I want to bring to you this morning, which I think resonates with some of the themes all the way through this conference. I sure as hell hope so. I brought along PowerPoint, but in the time, I'm not going to go through this. If you want to see what this guy looks like, you can come up to me afterwards and I'll show you the pictures. In the fall of 1867, a young man named John Muir lay delirious with malaria in a Florida coastal fishing village. He'd walked there from the Ohio River, a journey of 1,000 miles. This was immediately after the Civil War, encountering a deadly mosquito along the way. Fortunately for the world, Muir recovered from his illness, and decades later, by the end of the 19th century, he'd become the most famous writer in the state of California and the most famous conservationist in North America. An ardent lover of wild places, particularly the Sierra Nevada, the Yosemite Valley, the founding president of the Sierra Club, and the author of such classics as The Mountains of California, Our National Parks, Travels in Alaska. Some have called him the father, the founder of American environmentalism. But it was back in that Florida coastal fishing village, while prostrated with fever, that Muir wrote words that would echo through the rest of his life. Now, I must say I'm going to quote these words, and I'm not going to give you a very complicated picture of this man today. I don't have the time, and I've spent 500 pages writing about the complexities and the contradictions. I can't get into all that today, but I think this passage nonetheless resonates throughout the rest of his life. I would have put it on the screen, but I'm not going to mess with that. I'll just follow my words. I'll try to read slowly. The world, and he's lying there in a hammock, you know, sand dunes, the Gulf breeze is blowing in. The world, we are told, was made especially for man, a presumption that is totally unsupported by facts. A numerous class of men, I can't get the Scottish brogue in here, he's a Scotsman by origins, but you can imagine. A numerous class of men are painfully astonished whenever they find anything living or dead in all God's universe which they cannot eat or render in some way what they call useful to themselves. They have precise dogmatic insight of the intentions of the Creator, and it is hardly possible to be guilty of irreverence in speaking of their God, any more than of idol institutions of the Hindus. He is a civilized, that is their God, law-abiding gentleman, in favor either of a republican form of government or of a limited monarchy, believes in the literature and language of England, is a warm supporter of the English Constitution and Sunday schools and missionary societies, and is as purely a manufactured article as any puppet of a halfpenny or ha'penny theater. End of passage. Now, this, you could say, was written out of delirium. This passage dripping with irreverence and sarcasm has often been cited by Muir scholars as marking his moral rebellion against anthropocentrism, the old Judeo-Christian tradition, and so on. But I want you to take note of something that I noticed after I'd read this about 50 times. The political freight of those words, which has gone unremarked. Muir was writing not only as a defender of nature, but also as a critic of England's upper classes and their sense of superiority over other peoples, nations, and species. He was writing as a native son of Scotland, where before immigrating with his family to the United States, he'd been raised to despise the English lords and ladies who ruled his country, and to champion the rights of man and nature. I should add that he had been raised as the son of an uneducated shopkeeper who became a fundamentalist preacher who migrated to the United States, dragging his family along with him to a farm in backwoods Wisconsin. A father who was his whole life a seeker, a rebel. Muir's own formal education consisted of about a half dozen years of primary and secondary education, most of it in Scotland. There weren't even schools in Wisconsin he moved to, before finally being admitted to the University of Wisconsin in its earliest days, where he spent about 2 years altogether. So, but my point here is that besides being bitten by a mosquito, Muir had been bitten by a spirit of doubt and rebellion that was emphatically modern and Western. And that's mainly my thesis here this morning. Out of that spirit of rebellion against imposed hierarchy and empire came a new religion. Muir felt its first intimations in Scotland, but it was not until he reached California in 1868 that those intimations developed fully into what I will simply call the religion of nature. And let you theological experts sort out the language if you like. For an age that had begun to doubt its older religious traditions, which so often clashed with modern science and so often seemed in political terms to be arbitrary, hierarchical, and illiberal, Muir offered a spiritual vision that was at once in tune with science, was open-minded, liberal, and progressive in its politics, and was broadly egalitarian in its outlook. His family religion, which is based on the Church of England, Church of Scotland, and the Scottish Presbyterianism, was in some ways a fertile seedbed for that rising egalitarianism. Its great teachers, John Knox and John Calvin, rejected traditional Catholic doctrine and had made every man equal before their awesome God. Muir grew up praying long and hard for that God's forbearance and grace. But his new religion would leave Calvinist theology far behind. It would be focused not on a supernatural and miracle-working divine being living far above the earth in some sort of timeless fashion, but rather on the natural, the material, and the down-to-earth. Whatever Muir came to mean by God, and it's not easy to be sure. I've been through 55 reels of his letters and journals, and it's a mystery to me yet. But it is clear he found that God not in the Bible or in the doctrine of his ancestors, but among high peaks, alpine meadows, tall green forests, sequoia, sugar pine. God appeared to him everywhere in what he called the range of light, the Sierra Nevada. There he could touch it, the divine. He could sleep on it. He could hear it in the wind, climb its rocky slopes, be drenched in its pure, cold waters. Every aspect of the natural world, the western mountains above all, but the prairies full of wildflowers, the deserts baked by sun, the bleak gray skies of the Arctic, the tropical rainforest of South America, he saw all of these places in his lifetime, could satisfy Muir's craving for knowledge. He always began with that, knowledge, with kinship with other species, and with spiritual meaning. He wanted to know, as he put it, all the plant people. And he uses this word again and again, the plant people, the insect people. He didn't know a mosquito had bitten him, but he would have probably talked about the mosquito people. He thought it was a miasma that he picked up from some swamp in, you know, in the medical terminology of his day. He wanted to understand how a glacier works, how ancient trees got petrified and preserved for millions of years, how far a grasshopper can jump, he measured, how a dog can show courage as much as a man. The lowliest parts of nature, he taught and he believed, expressed order, grace, intelligence, and purpose. Muir's younger daughter testified that he never, in raising her in California, encouraged her to pray to a traditional deity. Here's what she remembered. His concept of God was a universal power or force governing the universe. The laws of nature were another way of saying the laws of God. He must have felt his God in the mountains, glaciers, forests, all of the outdoors, for surely he worshipped them, and through them he worshipped all nature, God's works. What I take from this is that Muir's daughter is indicating that he was neither a conventional Christian theist, although some have tried to make him into this, nor a post-Darwinian atheist, although he was a big admirer of Charles Darwin. Perhaps the best label for Muir's views when he first broke with Christianity is polytheism. For he came to worship both God and nature. And I'm not arguing that this is unique or unusual. I'm simply asking us to look at what in many ways is a very ordinary young man in 19th century America and Europe. Consistently, he capitalized both words and held them up as the twin deities of the world. God was often depicted as a masculine force, nature as feminine. This pair of deities shows up in Muir's 1869 journal, which is written in a California year and a half after his bout with malaria. This is a journal that became eventually my first summer in the Sierra. It's a rapturous book about his summer up there as a sheep herder. He hated the job. He hated sheep, but at least the kind of sheep he had to herd. But he fell in love that summer with this gentle wilderness, the Tuolumne Meadows, in what is now Yosemite National Park. The name God appears again and again in his journal passages that summer. Just to quote a few examples. The place seemed holy, where one might hope to see God. Or, God himself seems to be always doing his best here, working like a man in a glow of enthusiasm. At the same time, Muir attributes the magnificent beauty around him to the generative power of nature, as in these passages. The waving of a pine tree on the top of a mountain, a magic wand in nature's hand. So extravagant is nature with her choicest treasures, spending plant beauty as she spends sunshine, pouring it forth into land and sea, garden and desert. And then finally, and there are many, many examples, but as my selections here, Mother Nature is too often spoken of as in reality no mother at all. Yet how wisely, sternly, tenderly she loves and looks after her children in all sorts of weather and wilderness. In other words, God and nature here are co-designers of this world, two artists working in harmony. And Muir seems unwilling to decide which artist deserves the greater credit. Near the end of that 1868 journal, Muir brings these two divine powers together in a single passage, scribbled by a campfire's light. The whole wilderness seems to be alive and familiar, full of humanity. The very stones seem talkative, sympathetic, brotherly. No wonder when we consider that we all have the same father and mother. Now note that this new religion is not only polytheistic, but it's also egalitarian. All creatures, all forms of matter, the very rocks and cliffs share a common origin and eat together as brothers and sisters at a common table. This polytheistic language continues through the rest of Muir's life, as it does the lives of his contemporaries. Again, this is not set apart as some sort of strange aberration. Occasionally, Muir tended to blur this initial distinction between two deities and no longer represents them as a married couple of artists, but merges them into a single unity, a single divine power suffusing the earth. We could call that power androgynous, for it was both masculine and feminine, an indwelling creative force that had brought the world into existence and was, and I underline, progressively making the world better, which is to say, making the world more beautiful through time. A few years after that first summer in the Sierra, Muir jotted down new words in another campfire journal. And believe me, I've worn out my eyes on these journals, but so that you could have the benefit this morning. But in a passage that suggests that he was moving beyond polytheism toward a more, what we might call simply a pantheistic view of the world. And this is the phrase that is on a very tiny scrap of paper saved on microfilm. Beauty is God. What shall we say of God that we may not say of beauty? All is beauty. All is God. I call this simply pantheism. I don't know what, it's simply that middle ground, it seems to me, between Abrahamic monotheism of the Jewish, Christian, Muslim sort on the one hand, and modern secular atheism on the other. It's a broad, ill-defined territory. Michael York, in the famous Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature, describes pantheism as the ascription of divinity to the cosmos, or as simply the identification of God with the world, or as a denial that any part of the universe is distinct from God. The fact that York uses so many ors is an acknowledgement that pantheism is more a cluster of views than a single idea. I'm not going to get into cutting distinctions here between pantheism and panentheism and so on, because Muir was not a sophisticated theologian. He was not a philosopher. He wouldn't make it through your graduate seminars. He thought of himself as a scientist. He was an amateur naturalist who spent much of his time climbing peaks, collecting plants, developing what we would now call an expertise in ecology, biogeography, glaciology. He was offered positions at universities as a scientist. So I'm not claiming him here as a theologian or a philosopher in these terms, or asking him to somehow meet our standards of rigor in thinking. But my question here is really, where did Muir get these ideas? He didn't get them from American Indians. I mean, he met a lot of Indians later in his life and had very mixed reactions and feelings, some negative, some positive. He didn't get them from Hindu mystics. He got to India eventually, but in many other parts of the world. He didn't even really, I think, get them from the margins, the hidden streams of Western civilization. He got them from sources that were all around him, sources readily accessible to this rather weakly educated man. I would call him a self-made prophet, self-made man and a self-made prophet. He borrowed heavily, of course. I mean, he wasn't completely self-made. He borrowed heavily from a lot of people, and to go through that would be basically to go through my entire biography. But they included, and I want to emphasize this, several intelligent but now obscure female friends. He got a lot of his ideas out of a whole series of women he met. Professors' wives were a common, but women he met in Indianapolis, in Madison, Wisconsin, and later in California, who helped steer his thinking. These women published nothing. But it's interesting when you look through his eyes what he's getting from them in his conversations with them. I can identify more well-known, less obscure figures, but they're all male. And he certainly borrowed from them. Who helped him, as these women did, escape an orthodoxy which was fastened hard on the Bible as a supernatural and infallible revelation? All these teachers looked, as he did, to the magnificence and harmony of nature for their main source of faith. For example, there was the English poet John Milton, 17th century English poet, defender of freedom of speech, but also, of course, the author of Paradise Lost. The book that I think opened up the way for many Christians to embrace nature as the unspoiled and divinely created Garden of Eden. I don't know how you can get, you know, a rejection of nature out of John Milton. Paradise Lost is a celebration of the beauty and grandeur of the natural world. And John Muir knew John Milton by heart. He carried John Milton's Paradise Lost with him on his travels through that 1,000-mile walk. It was there with him in Florida. Another predecessor whose influence was undoubtedly important, although indirectly, was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the brilliant and controversial Swiss philosopher. Much in Rousseau's writings on politics, education, and religion finds echoes in Muir. Both men were raised in the Calvinist faith. Both abandoned that faith in their youth. Both stood in critical opposition to the society around them. Both imagined an egalitarian future that would extend beyond human society to include all forms of life. Muir is best known today as the harbinger of a more democratic and open society, but he was also the harbinger of Muir's religion of nature and of the movement to protect wild places and of the modern idea of a green society. But most important and most directly influential in Muir's thinking were a couple of northern British poets. And the geography, I think, is extremely important here. Robert Burns, above all else, and William Wordsworth, whom you might have suspected. Robert Burns, I mean, both of these people's writings he encountered as a boy in Scotland, in the schools. Robert Burns has almost dropped out of sight today, but, I mean, he still is the poet laureate of Scotland, but Muir knew everything that Burns had written. He memorized. He also carried Robert Burns' poems with him on his trek through the South. After a while, he could throw the book away because he had them all in his head. Robert Burns awakened in Muir, as he did many other young Scots, a sense of kinship toward all that lives, a suspicion of established authority and hierarchy. Wordsworth was, of course, Britain's prime example of a newly liberated religious mind seeking inspiration in nature. He famously described himself as a pagan suckled in a creed unknown. But let me add just a couple of others, and I don't want to go through a long bibliography here, just to suggest where Muir is coming from intellectually. Nature-affirming contemporaries such as Alexander von Humboldt, whose writings inspired John Muir a lot, the 19th century German explorer scientist who found order and harmony throughout the cosmos. And only later, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, the American transcendentalist who found miracles in the daily ordinary phenomenon of their New England woods. One further figure, Charles Darwin. Muir took from Darwin support for this basic religion of nature, not carrying it as far as Darwin would in terms of nature red in tooth and claw, but Darwin, he defended the rest of his life. All of these readers Muir read, and he carried their thoughts and language on his ramblings throughout the California mountains. But I want to emphasize that Muir's religion of nature was not simply shaped by poets and philosophers, male or female, but also by the rising tide of liberal democracy. And this is the political dimension that I want to. I don't have time here to go into a dissertation on what I mean here, but I'm not talking about neoclassical economics when I use the word liberal in this case. Muir called that the gobble-gobble school of economics. I'm talking about liberalism as he defined it and used it, as a kind of openness to new ideas, a resistance against orthodoxy, a promise of individual freedom and self-realization, of moral progress, of justice. In many cases, it seems to me, though not in all, but in enough, that, and I think we've missed this, many cases, this tide, this democratic tide, encouraged people to oppose Christian orthodoxy and to free their religious feelings from established dogma. Rousseau helped ignite the French, not only against the power of the state, but against the power of the church. While Burns and Wordsworth, both admirers of Rousseau, wanted to bring a Rousseau-like political and spiritual revolution home to their island kingdom ruled by entrenched elites. And again, both of these are people on the edges, on the perimeters of British Empire. That fusion of freedom, democracy, and the religion of nature came to be feared by religious and political conservatives on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Braun has already stolen my thunder here, but I'm going to come back. And I mean, his first day he quoted from this paper. But I want to come back to this passage from Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French political thinker of the 19th century. In the decade of Muir's birth, the 1830s, Tocqueville published his two-volume work, Democracy in America. And, you know, there are hundreds, thousands perhaps, books and articles on Tocqueville and his analysis of this democratic revolution. He was a privileged member of the aristocracy of France, but was struggling to understand what he called this irresistible revolution that was sweeping people like himself from power. It was breaking down entrenched institutions and challenging the privileges of high birth. We've had a lot of commentary on how Tocqueville embraced, or accepted at least, sometimes reluctantly, this democratic revolution. He came to the United States because he thought it was in the vanguard, but that it would eventually sweep over the world. And we've talked a lot about Tocqueville's penetrating insights into some of the internal tensions and contradictions in this democratic revolution, the tyranny of the majority, the possibilities of a rise of a new aristocracy within that democratic culture, industrial capitalism, the implications for gender and race relations and slavery and so on. But out of all of that literature, it seems to me strange that the critics have ignored one chapter. It's in the second volume, and it's called The Philosophical Consequences of Democracy. Now, you'd think with a title like that, it would get somebody's attention. It's a short chapter, but all his chapters are short. In this chapter, Tocqueville warns that the rising spirit of democracy will tend to encourage stronger and stronger feelings for nature. And as it did so, it would undermine the traditional anthropocentric doctrines of Christianity. It would put in their place, he feared, a new religion that he called pantheism. It's right there. He says, it cannot be denied that pantheism has made great progress in our time. Now, pantheism, as I suggested a moment ago, is only another word for the religion of nature. And pantheism, what Tocqueville is saying, is the natural outcome, the inevitable outcome, the natural religion of democracy. Now, not every frontier evangelist understood that. But they didn't understand the implications for slavery either, or women's rights. For a man raised within Roman Catholicism, this pantheistic tendency was one of the most dangerous threats posed by the new liberal egalitarian thinking. And Tocqueville solemnly urges at the end of this chapter, all those who still appreciate the true nature of man's greatness should combine in the struggle against it. Put it down. I think Tocqueville was right about his ageist tendencies. Nature, in the wake of the Democratic Revolution, became a new source of spirituality. Woods, mountains, prairies became places where anyone, male or female, rich or poor, could find answers to life's ultimate questions without the intervention of authority. That was one of the most profound consequences of the new political and social attitudes, a trend we often dismiss as mere romanticism without really understanding how closely linked it was to revolutionary politics and a rising democratic ethos. Thus, the case of John Muir suggests that the early environmental movement in the United States and perhaps in Europe and in other parts of the world was rooted in two interrelated sets of ideas: the religion of nature on the one hand and the principles of liberalism and democracy on the other. The fact that liberal democracy and a love of wild nature flourished as closely intertwined related ideas has not been well understood or appreciated by many scholars or by many modern-day social and environmental reformers. In fact, these two sets of ideas have often been viewed as completely separate or even as competitive or mutually exclusive. And thus, some social reformers calling for environmental justice or social justice have criticized environmentalism that talks about preserving the Sierra Nevada, the wildness, etc., as a distraction, as a competition, charging that the preserving of wild natural beauty has nothing to do with expanding democracy. Nature, as they have said, is even a fetish, a primitive fetish concocted by rich elite people who want to enjoy the beauty of wild places and exclude everyone else. Well, that characterization may fit a few environmentalists well enough, but I think it is a false reading of where the movement to conserve and protect nature comes from. It distorts the more complicated motive of past and present environmentalists, and it misses just how dangerous to hierarchy the love of natural beauty and wild places can be. Muir's example, and this is my conclusion, Muir's example helps us to remember these intertwined historical roots. Far from being a crabby expression of an elite conservatism flailing against the popular masses or against modernity, Muir's religion and his ethics were historically rooted in a revolutionary vision of a non-hierarchical and egalitarian society. It is the vision that modern environmentalists and their critics both would do well to understand better, and one that scholars need to examine and appreciate, to know how profoundly modern, how profoundly Western, how profoundly progressive, and how profoundly political the passion for nature has been. Thank you. Yeah, I don't think he ever lost what I've talked about here to become conventional, etc. He is hobnobbing with a lot of wealthy elite people and a little more orthodox people than, but almost everyone he deals with in later life, rich or poor, follows to some extent this loosening of orthodoxy and of their theistic beliefs. But, you know, Darwin does the same thing. He puts the creator back into a later edition. And he didn't do it because he was becoming theistic. I think he was concerned about driving people away. And there's something of that in Muir towards the end. But, you know, Muir does get old. And as you get old, and I can't go into all in great detail, he gets wealthy. He He dies, he's worth $4 million, mostly by inheriting through his marriage. He chose shrewdly when he chose a wife and gave him comfort for the rest of his life. And he made a lot of very rich, powerful friends. And I think by the time he gets into his 60s and 70s, he is becoming more conservative. Not as, he didn't go as far as Wordsworth did, but he's becoming a little more conservative. But I don't think where he ends up is back in Calvin's theology or Christianity. He never talks about Jesus as my personal savior. I mean, that's just not heard of here. Do you want to call on people?
How do you reconcile the longing for peaks and for peak experiences with the egalitarian pantheistic
world? You mean mountains are inherently elitist? Well, Muir said, Muir's own passage on this, I wouldn't say, I mean, he did climb a lot of mountains. His own passage on this is that we love mountains because we're psychologically immature. That's what he said. He said eventually when we become more mature in thinking about the natural world, we will learn to love rivers, meadows, the whole work, I mean, everything. Now, as a person from the Great Plains, I find this, you know, very comforting, that we are just not there yet.
Real quick question.
Yeah.
Is what you have laid out before us this morning in your book?
More or less. I've added some passages here. The polytheistic stuff and so on is implicit more than explicit.
But the union of democracy and nature,
yeah.
That's the major...
Yeah. That's my... If you want to say my... big quote-unquote idea in the book, other than the immense complexity and detail of his life and the people he met, etc. That is where I'm, what I'm trying to argue in this book.
I'm curious about the women he met along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The woman that was most influential was the wife of one of his college professors in Madison, Jean Carr. And her letter, she did publish a few things in her life, but not many. But she was extremely important in, one, pushing him into abandoning his idea of being a doctor or being a factory manager or a lot of other things. And she said, you have that inner eye, which means she had the inner eye to see into the reality of things, and you should essentially spend your life as writing about these sort of things. And she herself, she was from New England stock, had been affected by the transcendentalist, had grown up in an Orthodox Protestant family, but had left much of that behind, had no clear denominational roots, etc. So I think she's pushing him basically towards taking this religion seriously, taking your religious impulses seriously. Another one was Catherine Merrill, who became a professor in Indianapolis of the Bobbs Merrill famous family in publishing in the United States. She pushed him in the same direction, away from Calvinist orthodoxy, Protestantism, into this more, whatever we want to call it here. These are your feelings. They're real. Go into the woods. So it's hard to get too much from this except through a few letters now. And some of these people, he argued, he wanted to go farther than they wanted to go. Or they wanted him to come down to society, you know, and get married. And he fought this back and forth. He finally followed their recommendations. He wanted to stay in the mountains, and he didn't get married until he's in his mid-40s. But they thought he needed to also have the social dimension in his life, knowing what it was to be married and to raise children and to live within society. But eventually he takes their advice, and one of the women they picked out for him succeeded.
I want to remind everyone of the two other talks we've had, and there's a number of interesting connections. So please stay here, because I don't know where the next question is coming. But one connection I'll certainly see is between Anne Frank and the tree in the backyard. One might say that there was a kind of spontaneous spirituality of nature, where she found something in a cataclysmic world whole that was valuable. And she got through it by herself. herself has mirrored, for the most part, got to his most decisive insights by himself in a wild place. In my own work, certainly I find many people from around the world who arrive at similar insights, not from privileged backgrounds. So I think you've done a great service to excise, if you will, the canard that this kind of nature-related spirituality is just for affluent white folk. But nonetheless, I think we have some more questions. Jonathan, I think you were next.
What would you say to the criticism that the cemetery National Park was a sense rather sterile because no one was employed there? They were actually worked the land and earned the raven at some point there.
The criticisms that Yosemite is sterile because it doesn't have agriculture? Well, the original inhabitants didn't practice agriculture there either. Sorry?
There was a kind of economy.
Yeah, a gathering economy, gathering oak, so on. I don't think John Muir felt that a world without Native Americans was sterile. He was very sympathetic with the plight of Native Americans who were being pushed out of the landscape, particularly when he got to Alaska and saw the impact of American civilization on the coastal Alaskan Native peoples, and called for the government to try to do something to protect them in their places away from the Western economy. By the time he got to Yosemite Valley, the Natives were gone. I mean, there was a tiny, tiny village there. I don't know how many people were in it. It's on the map still, but the original population had been killed off. By the way, it was killed off not by white man, but by another Indian group who came in and massacred. They were enemies. But it did open the valley to white tourists. Who then, and the park was established some years after that had happened. Muir acknowledges a number of places the impact of Indians, like burning on the landscape and so on. His landscape, by the time he gets there, though, is pretty much empty of Native Americans. California Native Americans probably took a bigger hit than any place else in the world. Did he see this as an injustice? Yeah, he did. He contributed to causes, etc. Was he repelled by these Indians when he met a few of them? Yeah, he was. He found them very dirty. But he always sort of recoiled, and he quotes to himself when he has that feeling. He quotes Robert Burns. A man's a man for all that. And the, you know, that whole thing about eventually when the world is coming, we'll be brothers the world over. So I think he feels ashamed when he feels a certain hostility or repulsion towards these Native peoples.